We're getting near the end of Philippians, and this morning we're in chapter 4. I'd like to read verses 10 through 13, and this will be the basis for our study this morning. Philippians chapter 4, beginning with verse 10. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again, though surely you also did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Not long after I was born, there was a popular country song sung by Porter Wagner that was playing on the radio. And the lines went like this: how many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money, I'd do things my way. But little they know that it's so hard to find one rich man in ten with a satisfied mind. I looked up on Google the percentage of Americans who are satisfied with their life. I just read the headline, I didn't read the article. It said less than half of Americans are satisfied with their lives. Satisfaction is one of the hardest things to come by. Contentment, happiness with where you are in your situation in life. And here we read about Paul saying in the space of four verses, I've learned to be content, I've learned how to abound, I've learned how to be full. I've learned how to abound. And so here's a man who was satisfied. That despite the fact he was sitting in prison, despite the fact he wouldn't know many days for the rest of his life outside of a prison environment. And yet he said, I'm satisfied. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning, about what's involved in living a satisfied life. Years ago, I had a sermon I'd preach when I'd go out on meetings from the book of Philippians, and I'd have 4 points, one from each chapter. Chapter 1 would be the single mind for me to live as Christ. Chapter 2 would be the submitted mind, let this mind be in you which was in Christ Jesus. Chapter 3 would be the spiritual mind, our citizenship is in heaven. But in chapter 4, I would talk about the satisfied mind. And so we're going to take this text from Paul this morning, and I'll try to say some things I hope will be helpful. If you're not satisfied with your life, if you're not satisfied with your situation, maybe Paul can help us learn some things here. When I was young, the thing most people were afraid of was nuclear war. We had the bomb, the Russians got the bomb. We had atomic bombs, we got hydrogen bombs, the Russians got hydrogen bombs. I was part of that generation that would have the drills of where you'd push your desk to the center, toward the hallway in the center of the room, and you'd get under them in case a nuclear bomb went off nearby, as if that would help. But that's what we did. And people were afraid of nuclear war breaking out. There's a far scarier scenario that's discussed in the Bible. Turn to Revelation chapter 17. If Satan's going to get this world, he's not going to do it by nuclear war. He may scare some people along those lines, but he has far deadlier weapons at his disposal. Revelation chapter 17, verse 3 and verse 4. He carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, the red dragon of chapter 12, Satan himself. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. Here's what we ought to be afraid of. The one who is the blasphemer, slandering, speaking against everything that's right and pure and holy. The one who is adorned in the garments of this world, stones, costly clothes. The one who is full of fornication. Paul talked about those whose God is their belly, who serve their desires and their lust. In a word, what we need to be most concerned about is worldliness. This is a picture of worldliness. And it goes on in verse 6 to say that this woman was drunk on the blood of the saints. When you're a drunk, what do you need? You need more to drink. When you're addicted to something, you need more and more and more of it to get your fix. The devil is drunk on the souls of men, and he's out to get all that he can get. And one of the ways that manifests itself is in what this headline says. It doesn't matter how much you've got. Most people are always wanting more. I've read polls taken, one taken 30, 40 years ago I read, USA Today, the poll said they asked people making $30,000 a year, how much would it take for you to be really happy? They said $80,000. They asked the ones making $80,000 how much to be happy? $120,000. Asked the ones making $120,000 how much to be happy? $500,000. No one was ever happy at the level the people below the level thought they would be happy at if they ever got there. That's not the way addiction works. You get to where you want to be and you need more and more and more. And to be drunk on the things of this world is going to leave you perpetually discontent, unsatisfied, unhappy, floundering. It's going to leave you in immaturity. Growing up in Christ means learning what Paul learned that he talks of. Learning how to abound when we have nothing. Learning how to be full when our stomach is empty. Learning how to be satisfied when from a worldly perspective we have nothing to be satisfied about. Until we can learn those lessons, we are stuck in permanent spiritual immaturity. And so Paul is going to take on this subject. Here at the close of the Philippian letter, he turns to autobiography. His circumstances, he tells us, swung from one extreme to another, but not his contentment. His circumstances changed. His contentment never changed. His contentment was stable. It was consistent, calm. He, in terms of inner contentment, was on an even keel. Now, if you're not at that point, would you like to get to that point? To where no matter what happens, nationally, socially, in your family, with your health, no matter what happens, you can stay inwardly stable. You know, a lot of people, when they realize they're not satisfied, they go to Barnes & Noble and they buy books with titles like this, Seven Steps To, Five Keys To, Six Easy Steps To wherever they're wanting to get. Well, Paul's going to talk about just three things from the text this morning. Remember the context. Paul is as far from Philippi as we are from the northern boundary of Florida. If you took off driving down 75 into Florida, when you got to the state line between Georgia and Florida, that's how far Paul was from Philippi. He had gone to Philippi, started a church out by the riverside. And the only members of the church we really know anything about is a lady by the name of Lydia and a man in the church by the name of Epaphroditus. At the end of chapter 2, Paul talks about him, who had risked his life to carry a Philippian gift to him there in Rome. And Paul tells us something interesting, that the coming of Epaphroditus, look at chapter 2, verse 28 of Philippians. The coming of Epaphroditus caused him to rejoice, and he was less sorrowful. The English Standard Version says less anxious. Paul says when Epaphroditus got well, I was less anxious. Now, last week, chapter 4, verse 6, we read where Paul tells us, don't be anxious for anything. In nothing be anxious, but in everything be thankful. And here's Paul fessing up to being anxious about Epaphroditus. And I love passages like this because these are the passages that put the humanity back in the cockpit. And if you're not familiar with that phrase, it comes from the pilot, Sully. I think his last name was Sullivan, they called him Sully, who landed the plane a number of years ago in the East River, or in the Hudson maybe. They're on the west side of Manhattan. The plane took off out of LaGuardia, hit a flock of birds. Birds sucked into both engines. The plane loses power, and he lands in the river. Everybody was saved. Nobody was injured. Nobody hurt. But the insurance companies tried to accuse him of being a bad pilot. And they figured out that if he had done everything exactly right, with no waste of time, he could have landed that plane at Newark, which is right there across the river, or back at LaGuardia. And they didn't want to pay the insurance costs of the airline for losing that plane. And in the movie, Tom Hanks, I think, is the guy playing Sully. In the movie, when Sully finally takes the stand in the trial involving the insurance company, he says, "You know what you've done? You've taken all of the humanity out of the cockpit." Yeah, if I was a robot, as soon as those engines shut down, maybe I would have known exactly what. But I had to think about it. We had to look at all of our options. We had to figure out exactly where we were. That takes time that your models have not allowed for. It's one thing to say, never be anxious, but Paul was sometimes anxious. Christ said, "Am I going to ask God to deliver me from this hour?" He's going to ask that in John 12. We're almost there in our study. He says, "No, I'm not going to ask that. It was for this hour that I was born." And yet, just a few days later, Christ is asking God to deliver him from that hour. This is where the Bible really comes home to me as far as its humanity, its understanding of the human predicament. Paul doesn't want us to be anxious. Paul says, "I've learned how to be content." But you know what? When Paul wrote 2 Timothy, he said, "Timothy, there's some things I want. I want you. I want you to bring Mark, because he's profitable to me. I want you to bring my coat, my cloak that I left. I want you to bring some books I left behind." The man who said, "I've learned to be content," wanted some things. And I think what we must understand is that, sure, you want things. You want Epaphroditus to get better. You want this hour to pass. You want your cloak. You want your books. But if you don't get them, you're not destroyed by that. You're still content inside. So, let me talk about the three steps Paul gives for contentment. They involve, first of all, others, then ourself, then God. We need to know that others care. We need to be self-disciplined. And we need to trust God. And with those four things, we have a good basis for contentment. Now, Paul begins the section I read by saying, "I rejoiced greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again." Have you ever had someone say something like this? "Well, I'm really happy that you found time to come visit me." And they're not expressing appreciation, they're admonishing you. "Well, it was really nice to see you found time to drop me a card." And that's kind of what Paul says here, but that's not what he means. He was not criticizing them at all. The Philippians had been helping Paul out monetarily. They knew he had needs. They knew he needed funds. And they had been sending funds to him. But for a period of time, that had been disrupted. Not because they had lost interest. Not because they had not followed through. When Paul writes the Corinthians, Paul had told the Corinthians about a need they could help with. Needy saints in Judea could use your help. And the Corinthians said, "Man, we'll help." But when Paul writes the second letter, they hadn't followed through. They hadn't done anything. Paul says, "You express the desire, now do it. Follow through." That was not the Philippians. I think the Philippian situation is somewhat analogous to our situation with Andre in Orel, Russia. You know, for several years, one of the greatest works this church has ever undertaken is supporting the preaching of the gospel in Russia. And you're all to be commended for that. But for a number of years, it was very easy for us to get funds to Andre. Then a few years ago, the political climate between America and Russia went to pieces, and our government forbade any Americans to use Western Union or the normal means of transmission for sending money overseas. They're going to make Russia die on the vine. Russia's flourished. We're the ones economically dying on the vine. But we had to figure out a way to get funds there, and there was a lag there for a while. But God opened some doors for us, and we figured out a way, and we can now get funds to them. And you've got to know how much Orel appreciates you because of your commitment to that work. We need to know that others care. Paul rejoiced because the Philippians cared. Here are two or three thoughts about being generous in regard to others. Number one, generosity looks for opportunities. The Corinthians had stopped looking for an opportunity. Generosity looks for opportunities to be generous. And the Philippians were trying to find a way to get help to Paul. Now, how would you go about finding someone who's down on the state line of Florida, you're up here, if you don't have a cell phone and they don't have a cell phone? How would you go about finding them? I mean, that's Paul. He's traveling, he's moving from point to point. How is Philippi supposed to catch up with him? Well, it's going to be by word of mouth, most likely. And the ancients figured out ways to stay up with people. But when the Philippians finally tracked Paul down and knew how to reach him in Rome, they got help to him. Generous people look for opportunities to get help to people. We were talking this morning about Christ's criticism of Judas, who professed compassion for the poor. Oh, we could have helped the poor out with this oil that Mary's wasted. Christ said, Judas, if you want to help the poor, you've got the poor with you always. If you want to help somebody in need, spend a few minutes down at the gas station or at McDonald's or at the restaurant. You'll find. Spend a few minutes walking up and down your street wherever you live. You'll find somebody to help. Generosity looks for opportunity. Secondly, generosity is a means of fellowship. That's what Paul says, verse 14. You have shared in my distress. You are sharing in the preaching of the gospel in Russia. You are sharing in the help that we're lending to Lena and others in Orel who've needed medical help. You have shared in all of that, and God is not unmindful to forget what you've done. That's Hebrews 6 and verse 10. Christ says, what you're doing by sharing the gospel and the needs of people in Russia, you're laying up treasure in heaven. That's what you've done. Generosity accumulates to our account. Look at verse 17. Not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that abounds to your account. You're making a wise investment in the generosity that we as a church have shown to others. We get more out of it than they do. So you see, it's God's plan. This is 2 Corinthians 8:14. It's God's plan that our excess, our material financial excess, help the absence of money and care and funds for people who live on the other side of the world from us. God wants our abundance to help meet what others lack. And to know that others care is one of the great ways by which we help people reach contentment. Now, secondly, it's not enough to know that others care, although that's important. We must be self-disciplined. The only one we can control is ourselves. We can determine how we're going to react to circumstances. We cannot control the circumstances always, but we can certainly control our reaction to the circumstances. And so Number one, verse 17, we're not going to be covetous. Not that I seek a gift. Paul wanted them to know he was not looking for a handout. He was not sitting around doing nothing until he got some money from them. He's not in it for the money. Verse 11, chapter 4, not that I speak in regard to need. Because if you ask me how I'm doing, I'm going to tell you I'm doing all right. I'm doing fine. And again, Paul wanted things in his imprisonments, 2 Timothy chapter 4. But spiritually, Paul was doing fine. Are we doing fine? That's a question we each have to ask. Christ said in Matthew 6 that if we've got something to eat, if we've got something to drink, if we've got clothes to put on, we're doing fine. But we always want something else. You know, I've got a house full of stuff that I, over the years, have accumulated because for whatever reason I wanted it. And now when I look at all that stuff, you know what I also see? I see the biggest dumpster my kids can rent sitting out there in the driveway. And all of those treasures. And I'm having to tell them, don't throw this one away. This one you might want to hang on to. All of my treasures are going to be in that dumpster before very long. And I have no control over that. That's a circumstance of life that's going to come. But you ask me, if it was all thrown in today, how am I doing? I'm going to tell you I'm doing fine because I've got something to eat, drink, and wear. And that's spoken by the man who didn't know where he was going to sleep from one night to the next. The man who had not where to lay his head. And we can learn to be content. We can learn to be fine. Not just say it, but to be it when asked how we're doing, just like Paul learned it. And what I just said, I think, is one of the ways by which we learn contentment and grow spiritually, mature spiritually, is by keeping this life in perspective. We're just a vapor here for a little while, and then we're gone. And when we leave, we step into an eternity that we'll be in forever. And I think Paul understood that. He said, for me to leave is far better than staying here. But I'm willing to stick around for your benefit, Philippians chapter 1. Better to be without a body, but to be home with the Lord than to be here in this physical body that's taking me to the hospital and requiring medicine and this and that. But Paul says, well, I need to stay here for a while, I will. To gain the eternal perspective on our existence, on our being, is going, I think, to help us grow. Paul says in verse, what verse is it here? Verse 12. Let me show you something. In verse 11, he says, I have learned. And in verse 12, he says, I have learned. But he uses two different words in the Greek. In verse 11, he uses the word I have learned, which means to acquire knowledge. But in verse 12, the word he uses when he says, I have learned, is the word that meant to be initiated into the mysteries. Now, you may not know much about the Masonic Lodge. I certainly don't. I had to look up some stuff. But in the Masonic Lodge, they have 3 degrees. The first degree is the apprentice. You graduate, you learn stuff, you acquire information, you go from apprentice to journeyman. And you learn more and more, and then you go from journeyman to master mason. Those are the 3 degrees. And that's the word that that idea that the Masons incorporate came from the mystery religions of the ancients. And that's the word that Paul uses here. He had gotten up to the top level, to where he could be content and be happy, not fretting, not afraid, even though he had nothing. And that takes self-discipline. And thirdly, and most importantly, contentment means we trust God. Verse 13 again. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Now there's a story in the Old Testament, I'm going to close with this, that I think well illustrates what we're talking about. Back in Exodus chapter 17, Israel has left Egypt. God leads them out, maybe 2 million people. Maybe as many as 2 million Israelites leave Egypt and walk out into the desert. And I've seen that desert. I've seen what that desert looks like. I can't imagine signing up for a trip with a trip company, you know, takes you on tours. I can't imagine signing up for a tour. And we all get on the bus and we start out and there's no gas stations. There's no restaurants. There's no rest stops. We're on this road just going and going and there is nothing. You know what I'm going to start thinking? Who's driving this bus? Who planned this? This isn't what my idea of a tour is like. Well, that was the Israelites. 2 million people led out to where there's no food, no water, no nothing. And they start griping and complaining. And they're so upset, they are ready to stone Moses. They're ready to kill him. And Moses says, "Listen, Israel, you better be careful. You're tempting God." Remember the second temptation when the devil appeared before Christ and tried to get him to jump off the temple? And Christ says, "Satan, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." You know what it is to tempt God? It's to not trust Him. It's to require that He prove Himself trustworthy. It doesn't matter what He's done, first of all. It doesn't matter the 10 plagues. That doesn't matter. Doesn't matter He parts the Red Sea. What matters, He leads us out in the middle of nowhere. What have you done for me lately? And they're griping and complaining. And Moses says, "You are tempting God." In Psalm 81, verse 7, God talks about leading Israel out there into the desert. And God said, "I did that to test you, to find out what kind of faith you've got, to find out how much you trust me." Are you at the level that Paul was at in verse 13 where he can say, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me"? And sometimes that means I can feel full even when my belly's empty. I can maintain my joy even when it's been one tragedy after another. I can get there by the God who strengthens me. God will test us to see if we trust Him or if we're going to tempt Him. And what God does is not determined by what we think we need. It's determined by what God knows we need. And by God's eternal resources, infinite resources that can supply our need. So if we know others care, if we discipline ourselves and commit ourselves to growing, maturing spiritually, if we trust God above all, verse 20, "Now to our God and Father be glory forever and ever. Amen." To God be the glory. He'll get us through this temporal life, and when we close our eyes for the last time, we're going to step into a world like we cannot imagine. The sufferings of the present are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed.